get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we have a special show for you all today. With all the hullabaloo going on with the two least liked candidates in U.S. modern history running for president, one of which is going to win. Oh, I don't know, maybe we'll have a 2000 election repeat here, you know, and another Bush versus Gore. I don't know. We'll see. But sure, it's going to be even more interesting after the election, and I think it's been before the election. Anyway, we have a sane voice here, uncorrupted, and actually talking about issues that we're going to interview today. No less than Dr. Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate. We're really lucky to have Jill with us, and gee, we're going to talk about issues, something that the mud-throwing two candidates of the single corporate party of America, the two wings called Democrats and Republicans, have been doing for 3 or 4 months now, you know, just laying invectives against each other on who's more crooked and who's more crazy. It shows you how decadent American politics has become. It's an indication of the crisis of the political system. You know, you always have a moral crisis associated with the real crisis going on economically and politically. And, you know, no less than we see here, I have to mention this, the deep state is showing its teeth here. I'm talking about the FBI, which is part of the deep state. And those interests and individuals that really pull the strings behind the scene here, FBI is part of the deep security state, you know, with the NSA and the CIA and all those guys who are now emerging, trying to influence the election. Isn't it interesting? I'm talking about FBI Director Comey, who has injected himself in clear violation of the federal Hatch Act into the campaign. Is it a rogue deep stater here, Comey? You know, is he a rogue trying to cover his ass here for what he whitewashed of Clinton in July? Is that what's going on? Or is this sort of an indicator, a warning, a shot across the bow to the political candidates who do the bidding of the people who really run the show here? I don't know. We'll see whether the deep state will reveal itself even further going forward. Anyway, I'm going to shut up here because I want to talk to Jill Stein and bring some rationality and sense to a discussion of the issues. And boy, are there issues in this election, even though they're largely ignored by these two least-like candidates. I mean, polls show that two-thirds of Americans, 60 to 65%, depending on the poll, dislike both of these candidates. Two-thirds. I mean, the people are far smarter than these politicians, I think. American people aren't stupid, and they're beginning to get wise to what's going on here. And they dislike both of them. Well, how is it with such a dislike that the two parties, two wings of the corporate party of America, are throwing up these totally disliked candidates? I mean, is that democracy when two-thirds of the people don't want either of them? Is that democracy? I think not. I think we're in the twilight of American democracy here, the way things are going on a whole number of fronts. And this choice of Hillary and Trump. You know, Hillary, choose Hillary. Well, okay, choose Hillary so we can get some Supreme Court attendees. Yeah, and choose war, because that's where she's going. She's the war hawk here. And if she wins, watch what happens. The Republicans are still going to control the House, and we're going to see impeachment proceedings going on here, an investigation. The deep state's going to go after her hubby, Bill, and the foundations. Now we're beginning to see something, a little peek at how corrupt the foundations of the rich are, you know, and it's not just Hillary, it's all of them. You know, it's their slush fund. Foundations are the slush fund, how they pay themselves even more and loan each other money and so forth. I'd like to see a real investigation of the foundation system. Okay, so, and then if we get Trump, don't believe for a minute he's going to do anything about free trade. No way. Both of these candidates are talking through their teeth on that. They're pandering to people, and neither of them are going to do anything because guess what? The big money bags want free trade, and they're going to keep free trade some way, right? If Trump wins, what are we going to get? More civil liberties crisis. We're going to get some super right-wingers on the Supreme Court, not two, three, four Scalias maybe, right? And what's going to happen with the healthcare system now escalating costs and premiums? And, you know, just as I predicted for years here, the ACA, Obamacare, is going to implode because the cost is going to continue to rise nonetheless. Okay. Gee, I said I'm going to back off here, and I'm going to do it now. All right. Jill, I can't, Jill, I can't help it. I'm like a lot of other people out there. I'm just so angry at what I see going on here and the decline in decadence. Give us a breath of fresh air. Let's talk about some issues, okay?
Well, and let me just say that, you know, this really is it's a transformative moment right now. And the political establishment is terrified. They are terrified that the American people, 80% of which, according to a poll in today's New York Times, 80% of Americans are not just like off-put or discouraged or think we're on the wrong track. They are repulsed by what this, and that's the word that they use, repulsed, disgusted by what this election says about our political system, where we are basically being force-fed. We are having shoved down our throats and denied the knowledge and power of knowing that there are other options, including my campaign, which is the only campaign that is not poisoned by corporate money, by lobbyist money, and by having a super PAC, having or coordinating with, because that's what they all do. They coordinate with these super PACs, which are unlimited donations, you know, so-called independent donations. But, you know, they are not independent by any means. You know, this is an incredibly corrupt system, and people are being denied the knowledge that there are two other candidates, one of whom actually represents the antithesis of this incredibly corrupt an abhorrent system. So, you know, I would just encourage people to take heart that, you know, that we are being browbeaten into surrender right now, and as well as denied that there's knowledge and denied that there is another option. But those who are listening, you know, those who are listening are hereby empowered to know that there is another option, that we can reject both catastrophic neoliberalism and neo-fascism. You know, they're both catastrophes, and we don't have to surrender to either of them. We don't have to buy into this race to the bottom between the lesser and the greater evil. There is no doubt that the lesser evil paves the way to the greater evil. It's not a solution. You may think it is for the moment, but in fact, you know, people don't come out to vote for lesser evil politicians and lesser evil political parties that are also throwing them under the bus. So the Republicans win anyhow. They take over Congress, as they did one house after the other after Obama's victory in 2008. You know, so the lesser evil is just, it's in a race to the bottom with the greater evil, and the politics of fear delivers everything that we're afraid of. That is the track record. All the reasons that you're told to vote for the lesser evil, because you didn't want the expanding wars. You didn't want the meltdown of the climate. You didn't want the massive Wall Street bailouts and the offshoring of our jobs and the oppression of workers and wages and the deportations of immigrants. This is exactly what we've gotten by allowing ourselves as the public interest to be silenced. And what people need to remember is that this is not the year 2000. As courageous as Ralph Nader was, he was ahead of his day. But people have caught up right now. And the majority of voters has rejected both of these candidates and has rejected both of these predatory political parties. So we actually have the numbers that it takes to actually have a voter revolt. The number of people locked into predatory student loan debt, which is 43 million, that alone is enough to win the election if student debtors learned that there's actually a way for them to come out and effectively cancel their student debt by voting green. So we actually do have the power. We have the numbers. We have the solutions. All we need, you know, are the airwaves to get the word out, because people are fighting angry. 4 out of 10 people are not going to vote in this election, according to the New York Times, given only the choice of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So there is a way forward. And it doesn't end on November 8th. And I really encourage people to not only check out our campaign, Jill2016.com, or Dr. Jill Stein, that's DR, no period, on social media, you know, but plug in, because we're not going away. The crises we face now are not going to get better, not under Donald Trump and not under Hillary Clinton. Clinton laid the groundwork. Both Clintons laid the groundwork for the economic crisis that has led to the rise of right-wing extremism in this country and around the world. You know, the neoliberal policies of Wall Street deregulation, leading to the crash and the, you know, the disappearance of 9 million jobs, the theft of 5 million homes. NAFTA, again, brought to us by Bill Clinton, supported by Hillary. The crime reform bill, so-called, of the 1990s that opened the floodgates to mass incarceration, and even the militarization of the border and the recruitment of local police into the immigration enforcement. So the groundwork for the deportation system that we now have under Barack Obama, that was laid by Bill Clinton with the support of Hillary as well. So these policies of the Clintons do not fix this crisis. You can be sure, whether it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton in the White House, the flames will be fanned. The flames of crisis will only be fanned. We are the solution. We are the ones we've been waiting for. I encourage people right off the bat here, I want to get it, you know, on the record, I encourage you to vote green. We are very close to the 5% threshold, according to a poll yesterday by NBC, I believe, and the New York Times. We were at 4%, and these polls systematically undercount the voters who are our base, that is millennials, immigrants, people of color. So we could very well be at that threshold, at which we receive between $8 and $10 million minimum of matching funds in the next presidential race. And we also have automatic ballot access in most states. So it's a whole new ball game going forward, particularly if we have hit that 5% threshold. So I would just encourage people to, you know, act on the courage of our convictions and stand up with the power that we actually have and begin to build that right now by standing up strong and building a real politics of integrity. We need our social movements, but those social movements also need to get political traction by challenging power. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. We have to be that demand and to bring that demand into the political arena, into the voting booth, where in fact we can win the minute we stand up and get the word out and organize. We actually have the numbers, not to split the vote, but to actually flip the vote. So that power is not in our hopes, it's not in our dreams, it's right here in our hands.
Well, that's an excellent statement. you know, our listeners should keep in mind. I've been watching and writing about following the evolution of the U.S. economy since the 1980s. And regardless if it's Democrats or Republicans, it's neoliberal, and it's all a continuation. All these policies are a continuation, whether it's financialization or the destruction of pensions and retirement, or the end of affordable health care, or student education costs, or prescription drugs, or taxes, or trade, or whatever. It's all the same thing. It's all the same policies. Different emphasis, maybe, from one candidate to the next, but very clearly, the Republicans get in office and they wreck the economy in the process of enriching their wealthy benefactors. And then that creates a situation for the Democrats to come in, and what do? They recover the economy on behalf of the same wealthy benefactors. So one wrecks it and the other says they resolve it, but in both cases, they only make the rich richer. You know, independent IRS-based data analysis shows that the wealthiest 1% under Obama have increased their share of the net income in the country by 90. They've got 95% of all the income gains since 2009. 95% under Bill Clinton, it was 68%. I mean, excuse me, under Bush, 68%. Under Clinton, 45%.
Wow.
It's just getting bigger and bigger. They're getting bigger and bigger.
Wow.
Take, you know. And this, by the way, is, you know, not some wild estimates. This comes from the University of California Professor Emmanuel Saez, who has done these calculations based on IRS data. Okay, that's IRS data. Wow. So it's probably even worse because there is tax avoidance and tax fraud involved with the data as well. I mean, this tells you everything. Who are these two parties working on behalf of? You hear a lot about Barack Obama, 10 million jobs he's created. Well, 6 million of those were lost during the 2008-09 downturn. So, you know, he's gained 4 to 5 million jobs since then. But, you know, today a report just came out from Fidelity, the mutual fund, an article that shows that nearly all of these jobs are part-time temp contract service gig low-paid jobs. You know, so we've lost the high-paid jobs, and we've replaced them with low-paid jobs. I mean, is that a recovery? No, that's not a recovery at all. Hey, I want you to tell us what your program is. I'm going to ask you a series of questions about what does the Green Party propose for taxes, trade, health care, so on and so forth. And if you can answer me each one of these, for the record, for the listeners, a couple of sentences or paragraphs each, let's get on the record how your program is a program that addresses the real issues. Let's let the listeners hear where the real solution is, okay? Let's
Sounds
start with
great.
Taxes. With taxes, you know, we've got Trump, $10 trillion more dollars. We've already given wealthy and corporations $10 trillion tax cuts since 2003. More under Obama, by the way, than even under George W. Bush. Trump wants to give him another $10 trillion, and Hillary wants to give him $5 trillion. What's your tax proposal?
Well, it's kind of the antidote to that. We want to raise taxes on the very rich in all kinds of ways. We need to restore the inheritance tax, which has basically been disappeared starting, you know, well, it's gone on for a while, but particularly George Bush. The Bush tax cuts massively reduced the inheritance tax. And then few people know that Barack Obama actually made the Bush tax cuts for the rich permanent. So all that destruction that George Bush did, Barack Obama, you know, did it on steroids. So we would reverse.
Which was a $5 trillion tax cut in 2013, by the way. Go ahead.
There you go. Yeah. So we would basically reverse all of the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy and then some, so that we would restore the tax on capital gains. I would like to see capital gains taxed like wages, so that it is taxed progressively, and that we need to restore the upper levels, the higher marginal levels, so that we have a truly progressive income tax, because our state and local taxes are largely regressive. We rely on the federal taxes to counteract that. And under Reagan, I believe it was, you know, the top marginal rate was as high as 50%. Now it's 39. Under Eisenhower, it was 90%, you know. So it needs to be somewhere at least where it was under Reagan. And for the richest levels of the rich, it needs to be up there at 70-80%.
Let me just add to that something. You know,
yes.
People say, well, 35%, 39% tax on corporations and the wealthy is higher than any other country in the world. We can't raise the income tax. Well, the tax rate is not the important indicator. It's the effective tax rate. And what effectively do the rich and corporations pay in income tax? 12.2% is the effective number. 12.2,
right.
Not 35, because there's so many loopholes. Go ahead.
That's right. And corporations, some, you know, 30, 40 years ago, were paying a significant share. They were paying like 30% of the federal tax burden. They paid a share. That 30% has been reduced to something like 10% right now. So it's basically been shredded by, you know, by about two-thirds. It's been massively reduced. So we need to restore those rates. We need we need to ensure that corporations are not weaseling out of their tax. We need to tax offshore profits, which are, you know, some $2.4 trillion, which are being hoarded offshore, essentially for tax avoidance, through shelters of various sorts, including these so-called tax inversions, which need to be ended and restored to their, you know, their rightful structure, so that corporations are paying taxes and not offshoring their business and their profits. And that should be, you know, taxed at a full corporate tax rate.
Does that include a financial transaction tax right now?
Sorry,
Jill, does that include a financial transaction tax? Is that part of your program?
I would add, yes, that is in addition. Yes, we would call for a financial transaction tax at least of 0.2%, which would, you know, that's a tiny fraction. Everyday people are paying 5 to 10% of a sales tax. The wealthiest sector of the economy, Wall Street, does not pay any sales tax whatsoever. A 0.2% tiny tax on Wall Street transactions would actually be good for the economy, because it reduces these predatory transactions that are based on essentially small mathematical differences, and which move money instantaneously simply to try to gamble. These are not investments. These are not a thoughtful use of investment dollars. This is strictly gaming the system. So a transaction tax reduces that kind of gaming, and it would generate, according to the sources I've seen, between $300 and $400 billion a year just at a 0.2% rate. So that's the least that we ought to be considering for a financial transaction tax. And, of course, you know, the capital gains taxes and the tax on dividends need to be raised at least, you know, to the level of taxed at wages, and that means progressively, including at the upper levels, which is where most of this income is applied, to the richest 20%. And so at the highest level, it should be taxed higher.
Most of the stock trades are owned by the wealthiest 5%. Something like 90% of all stock trades are done by 5%, not even the 20%. The other 15% are people who have 401ks and they don't really trade and so forth. But let's move on to trade.
Great.
What's your position on free trade and trade compared to the others?
So-called free trade is a scam. is essentially a corporate free-for-all for corporations, and it's devastating for workers and for the environment, particularly because these new trade agreements, starting with NAFTA, and even more so with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, these trade agreements essentially make corporations more powerful than nations, and they destroy national sovereignty. They create a system of international courts appointed by the World Bank, and these are largely corporate lawyers who then get to decide whether corporations are being denied their future profits by our democratically enacted laws and regulations to protect workers, to protect public health, to protect the environment, to protect our communities, to stop financial fraud, to enable us to negotiate bulk purchasing and reasonable prices for pharmaceuticals in order to favor locally produced materials, renewable energy, you name it. It all becomes subject to this outrageous system of investor trade dispute system that makes multinational corporations more powerful than us. It essentially overrides national mind-boggling to me that anyone who supports this is not a tried for truth. This is an adversarial concept.
You're breaking up a little bit. Let me just interject here and see if we can get your signal back a little bit, Jill. But okay, it sounds like you're back here. Okay, go ahead. Continue.
Okay. All right, great. Did you hear my rant about sovereignty and
we missed that. I think the point is all these free trade agreements are the beginning of a global corporate government system.
Exactly.
And to the extent they have any of these treaties, they negate your elected representatives' abilities to pass laws and our courts to rule on laws that maybe people want. In other words, you give up democracy. That's maybe
exactly
one of the worst things about these free trade agreements. It's another important aspect of the attack on democracy, the corporate attack on democracy that's going on. You give up democratic sovereignty. The people give up their sovereignty in these, and your legislatures cannot contradict these treaties, and the corporations get their way. Go ahead.
Exactly. A case in point, you know, is the KXL pipeline, the Keystone pipeline. The TransCanada is challenging the termination of the Keystone pipeline. You know, we the people demanded that devastating pipeline be stopped. So we forced the White House, we forced the hand of Obama to deny the permit. Well, now the Keystone Pipeline Company, TransCanada, has taken the United States taxpayers to court, demanding that we pay some $12 billion for a $3 billion pipeline. We're being sued many times over for having asserted our democratic rights to decide what kind of pollution we will tolerate, what kind of health impacts, and what kind of energy system we want, and what kind of climate future we want. We are going to be taxed to the teeth on account of that. So it's absolutely, you know, outrageous that we are being fined and our national sovereignty is being challenged.
Let's move on to health care. Okay, we have a situation today, as I had predicted years ago, that the pending cost runaway with Obamacare, and you know, we still have 25 million people uninsured here. We were told that you know, the 50 million would be have some kind of insurance, but there are no controls on prices, and we see the prescription drug companies gouging us everywhere and driving up health care costs and premiums, even for employer-provided health care. What would you do about Obamacare and the health care crisis in this country?
So first, just one really quick final thought on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That is that Hillary Clinton pretends she opposes it, but her vice presidential candidate and her director of transition, Ken Salazar, are big enthusiasts for it. And even her her political friend, the governor of Virginia, has said that she will change her mind when she's back in office. She will make some very superficial tweak to the law, and then she will drive it home. So it's very important. Where is she now in opposing it? There is this threat of a lame duck passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, another assault on democracy for this to be done in lame duck session by congressmen and women who will not be accountable and who are not returning into service. It's outrageous, and she should be standing up and demanding that there be no lame duck passage. But of course, she's silent. So you can be sure that she is going to be on board. And Donald Trump pretends that he opposes offshoring of our jobs. But what has he done with his jobs? Every product that he markets, every product that he has manufactured is produced overseas. So he says one thing, but he does another. So working people should not be fooled into thinking that Donald Trump is the alternative to a corrupt Hillary Clinton. Unfortunately, Donald Trump, you know, is a member of the billionaire class, and he got there by abusing working people and students and immigrants and workers and all the rest, and he should not be trusted. So, you know, don't drink the Kool-Aid. Stand up for what we deserve and vote for a real campaign that will actually oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. My record and the Green Party record has always been very clear on all sides of the Atlantic, because the Green Party and the Pacific, the Green Party is an international political party. We are fighting the Trans-Pacific Partnership all over the world, and we have a very clear record out of office and in office.
Hillary's position on free trade reminds me of Obama's position. When Obama was running in the spring of 2008, he was opposed to free trade as well. And he came out and said, just as Hillary says, I'm not in favor of NAFTA. But then it turned out behind the scenes, when the Canadians got upset, Obama sent one of his advisors to the to Canada and said, we're just talking about this. We don't really mean this.
God.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah, this is all documented. This is all documented in my book, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few. I quote the sources in this. Well, Hillary's doing the same thing. You know, I mean, Obama turned around, became the biggest free trader, in our history, right? The biggest deporter of Latinos. And, his record is abysmal. Well, you think that Hillary is any different? I don't think so. I think both of these candidates, as you said, are just pandering to people, telling them what they think they want to hear on free trade, because it's been devastating jobs and devastating standards of living, particularly for the non-college-educated working class in this country, both colored and white. And they're saying what they think people want to hear, and they're going to turn around and do what their money bags, who pay for their elections, tell them to do on free trade. And I absolutely agree with you. And there's going to be a big push here in the lame duck session to push it through. And neither of these candidates, if they are either is elected, is going to oppose that. They're going to remain silent.
That's
right. Let's talk about health care. Let's move on to health care here. I want to get through a number of issues and get you on the record here, and hopefully people will hear reasoned positions on programs. Health care. We got runaway health care premiums occurring. We got people who can only afford catastrophic care, $5,000 deductibles, right, in order to afford the premiums, and the premiums are going up anyway, and the prescription drug companies are gouging us with 1,000% increases in life-saving drugs, driving up the cost everywhere in general for health care. Not only the ACA, but regular employer-provided health care. What would you do differently about health care?
Very simply, we would move to an improved Medicare for all. a system that costs us no more than what we are paying right now. It simply redistributes that cost in a way that is far more fair, progressively, and it redirects money. 25% of your healthcare dollar right now is diverted into bureaucracy, red tape, paper pushing, and profiteering. Instead, that 25% of overhead is reduced to 2% of overhead, which is what it costs under Medicare. And instead, those dollars, it's about $500 billion, gets put into expanding care to cover everyone and to cover you comprehensively. So it's everybody in, nobody out. You're covered cradle to grave and from head to toe, including your pharmaceuticals, your mental health care, your reproductive health care, your chronic care, your hearing aids, your insulin pump, whatever it is, things are included, which are all kind of cut out now. That's why we call for an improved Medicare for all, to be sure that there are no holes in the coverage, that everything is covered. And simply by removing the profiteering and the middleman and the mountain of minutiae that goes into tracking costs under our current, you know, many-layered privatized system, just moving those, eliminating that waste, enables us to cover actual health care for everyone.
It's amazing to me that people don't understand that Medicare for All, Medicare covers 50 million people now. What's the cost of it? 2.9% tax. 2.9%. Even if we double that to a 6% tax, okay. Mm-hmm. You look at what are people covered by their employer health care plans paying. Yeah. I know my family. Yeah. I got family members, teachers, high school teachers. Okay, what do they pay? They mm-hmm. and their employer. 25% of their income is the premium they pay for health care. So instead of 25%, you mm-hmm. pay 5 or 6%. I mean, the math is so simple here that people only understood Medicare for All is the solution to the whole crisis. Let's go on to student debt. I know you've got a great program on student debt. Tell us what it is.
Well, our program is very simple. If we bailed out the crooks on Wall Street when they crashed the economy, you know, we bailed them out. We made money available when they needed it, and that was $16 trillion, and some say even more. If we could come up with $16 trillion to bail out the crooks, we can come up with $1.3 trillion to bail out the students. And there are many different ways to do this. One way, for example, would be instead of creating a new generation of nuclear weapons, which are a threat, a rather immediate and devastating threat to every living being on the planet right now. We are in the most dangerous nuclear moment in all of human history right now, and that's according to Mikhail Gorbachev, the former president of the Soviet Union, so he would have a very good perspective on this. Instead of creating a new generation of nuclear weapons at the cost of $1 trillion, how about we create a new generation of liberated young people who are freed from their debt for approximately that $1 trillion. Let's trade off here a devastating nuclear weapons program, which only increases the nuclear arms race and the danger to everyone. Instead, let's liberate a generation of young people to actually go out and be economic actors in the new economy and create the new economy for the 21st century. It is the economic stimulus package of our dreams, because they're already trained. They have their degrees. They have their passion. They need to be turned loose to actually lead our economy forward. That is the simple story. There are other ways that this can be paid for as well that are more complicated or more or less controversial. But the point is, we can do this. If we did it for Wall Street, we can do it for our younger generation. No society has ever survived by devouring its young. But that is actually what is happening right now. Young people are being devoured by a predatory economy. They need to be unleashed and turned loose to transform this economy, not only economically, but also as the leading edge of social transformation, whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement or the climate justice movement or the living wage movement. it's usually young people out there on the front line who are leading those transformative movements. And we need to unleash them now, not only to revive our economy, but also to lead the way forward in the struggle for critical social change.
Yeah, I don't know why all millennials don't vote green, by the way. They are the ones being devastated by the policies more than any other group. I'm talking about the 30, 35 and under group. They're the ones that are, $1 trillion in debt. They're the ones that can only, when they graduate, get part-time, low-paid service jobs. They're the ones, 40% of which can't even afford their own apartment, let alone get married and have a home. 40% living with their parents. I mean, it's devastating. We're devastating this 75 million population subgroup in the country. Certainly, student debt would go a long way. Lifting student debt to allow them to have a decent standard of living. What's your position on free public college tuition?
It's a no-brainer. It pays for itself. We know that from the GI Bill that provided college education for soldiers returning after the Second World War. And what we found, because Congress was keeping close watch, for every dollar of taxpayer money that went into free college education, we actually got back $7 in improved revenues and public benefits. So it more than pays for itself. There are countries around the world who provide free public higher education who have far fewer resources than we do. And many people in my generation were actually educated, and they got, college and graduate school degrees for practically free at public colleges and universities. So we can afford to do this now. This is one of the reasons why we need to cut the military budget, which is only making us less safe, not more safe, but it's also another reason why we need to insist that the wealthy few who are making out like bandits need to start contributing again to the economy that we all need if we're going to get out of here alive.
Let's talk about the retirement crisis. We have 48 million seniors, retirees, trying to struggle on Social Security that averages $1,100 a month with no savings interest increase for 8 years, with interest rates by the Federal Reserve at virtually zero for these folks, which is pretty much just been a subsidy for bankers. They love the low interest, they on the spread they've made hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars because of the near zero interest rates for 8 years, and grandma and grandpa in retirement have made zilch, nothing.
Wow.
What's your policy on retirement and the Federal Reserve raising interest rates?
Well,
what's your policy on Social Security and pensions? Social Security and pensions.
Yeah, let me address that first. So we need to be expanding Social Security benefits, not talking about cutting them or withholding cost of living increases. Social Security should roughly be doubled in order to really, begin providing a secure retirement. And fortunately, this is something we can do. The limits on Social Security are really concocted. They're really engineered. There's nothing insecure about Social Security except for the, the predatory intentions of our elected officials who are more interested in serving their campaign sponsors than retiring generations. So simply by lifting the cap on the contribution based on wages, that cap should be absolutely lifted, so that currently, what is it? It's $118,000 is the payroll tax cap. So that, in other words, this is a very regressive tax, and those who are wealthiest are most protected. It's absolutely ridiculous. Most people, don't even know about it.
If I'm a millionaire, I don't pay anything, no payroll tax after my first $118,000 earnings. After that, I get a big tax break.
It's unbelievable.
We've got about 20% of wage earners, but not just wage earners, those who make their earnings from interest and dividends and so forth, they pay No Social Security tax.
Exactly. Nothing. And so the Social Security tax needs to be applied to investment income. That's done for Medicare, and it's ridiculous that it's not being done for Social Security. So those two reforms alone would not only make Social Security secure and solvent for the long haul, but it would also enable us to begin raising Social Security benefits. So, for example, right now there are hundreds of billions of taxpayer subsidies for the wealthy retirement investment packages for the 401ks and the IRAs. So that needs to be basically capped or ended or reduced so that the wealthy don't get off here with these cushy retirement packages while everyday people are really left on in poverty. That has to end, and that can be ended. So, you know, this is entirely solvable. This is all about daring to stand up for the solutions that we deserve and working together across issues, because one issue at a time, we're divided and conquered, and we never get to critical mass. But when we stand together as a broad agenda for people, planet, and peace over profit, we have all the numbers we need to actually enact this agenda.
Let's move on to non-economic issues. Who would you appoint to the Supreme Court?
So, you know, there are a variety of wonderful people who should be considered. I would say, you know, in general, we need people who will stand up for workers' rights, women's rights and reproductive rights, immigrant rights, and also on the necessity to end this domination of our political system by oligarchy. That is this nonsense idea, a court-generated idea, that money is equal to free speech. Because the minute you say that, and that's basically the concept underlying Citizens United, that there should be no limits on the billionaire's ability to buy influence in our elections and to propagate their point of view. Well, if you get a megaphone that is as big as your investments, that means that wealthy people have an enormous megaphone, but that the majority of Americans have none at all. That's not a fair political system if money determines, you know, that's like saying it's $1, one vote. It's not $1, one vote. You know, it's one person, one vote. And so we need to end this concept that money is speech, and also end the concept that corporations have the rights of people. Because when those rights are applied, it's essentially to undermine the laws that we the people establish in order to protect our health, our environment, our workers, our future, et cetera. Corporations should not have the ability to go to court and say, you are discriminating against me because you're protecting your public health. But that is the outrageous misuse of our political system. So I will certainly support Supreme Court nominees who will help to set that right so that we can properly interpret the Constitution in order to return human rights that have been given to corporations and restore them to we, the people.
So it sounds like you would, correct me if I'm wrong, appoint only people who would be in favor in the Supreme Court to repeal Citizens United.
Absolutely. That's right.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
And I I'd be also very interested, you know, in helping continue the evolution of the Supreme Court so it looks more like the American people. And, you know, that's not only more women on the Supreme Court, but it's, you know, Asian Americans and an African American woman and an indigenous American. There's one very interesting professor of law who's co-dean at Rutgers, who is a very outspoken proponent of civil liberties and immigrant rights, named Ronald K. Chen. He would certainly be on the short list, along with Colette Pynchon Battle, who is an environmental and climate justice activist, also an African-American woman. They would be, you know, among those on a short list.
Okay. Let's talk about immigration. A preface here. You know, we know Trump, his big issue on immigration. targeting Latin Americans, people of color from Latin America and Muslim Americans, right? But if you look at what jobs these undocumented are taking, you know, it's mostly cleaning hotel rooms, working in restaurants, mm-hmm. Cleaning up, basic construction, unskilled construction labor, people doing yard work and gardening, agricultural labor, and, you know, one of the worst jobs you could possibly have, slaughtering beef, pork, and chickens. This is where mm-hmm. all these people are virtually working. These are jobs that Americans don't already here, second, third generation, aren't very interested in. So, you know, these people are not taking jobs. They're doing work that otherwise we wouldn't have people available to do. But yet, you know, you see Trump attacking just those people, a racist attack on just those people, and saying nothing about the skilled people coming in, mostly from Asia, on H-1B and L-1 visas, 300,000 a year, legal immigration, taking software engineering and other engineering jobs. Mm. You know, they say mm-hmm. nothing about those 300,000 every year mm-hmm. taking high-paid jobs that Americans do want. Kids graduating from college with computer science degrees and can't get jobs because they're going to these immigrants from skilled immigrants who don't become mm-hmm. citizens, go back to their country eventually. But no one's saying anything about the H-1B visa problem or L-1 visa problems. What's your position on immigration, both the attacks on Latin Americans and this H-1B crisis situation?
Yeah, so, you know, this is it's really a scandal that we have done so much to create an immigration crisis, particularly in Latin America, where NAFTA put millions of farmers out of work, and they were forced to flee here as refugees in order to feed their families, or the destabilization of democracy, like Honduras, where Hillary Clinton herself gave the thumbs up to the corporate mm-hmm. military coup in Honduras that has ushered in this incredible era of violence from which tens of thousands of people have fled directly because of that U.S.-supported coup. Or Guatemala, you know, where we destabilized the democracy in Guatemala generations ago, creating generations of incredible violence and military rule, where our School of the Americas has actually trained death squads that have been used all over Latin America. So, and then add to that the drug wars, where essentially our drug policy, our prohibition policy, has created this incredible violence, a subculture of violence, not just in our country, but especially in Mexico and Colombia. And this is a disaster that is driving so much of the migration problem. So we basically create an immigration crisis, and then we criminalize people when they come here. So we're calling for, number one, you know, let's stop creating this crisis. And in fact, we call for a Marshall Plan type situation so that we are helping to stabilize the economies, to help promote truly community-based economic development so that people don't have to flee here and tear their communities apart in order to have a means of survival. It also means going back and renegotiating NAFTA and, preventing the Trans-Pacific Partnership so that we have just trade agreements that are supportive to workers and to a more just and stable economy. It means supporting real democracies, not overturning them because we're looking for greater corporate influence. So there's so much we can do right there to stop the problem in its origins. And then in addition, we need to create a welcoming path to citizenship for the immigrants who, as you point out, have always been at the core of our economies and our communities.
I bet if we asked our listenership how many grandparents immigrated to the U.S., how many of their grandparents immigrated to the U.S. or great-grandparents, you probably would find a majority who would say, yeah, I have grandparents who immigrated here, you know.
In fact, the
whole immigration thing is a distraction to blame the victims.
Yes.
For the crisis these wealthy politicians have created. In the time we got left, though,
exactly.
I want you to say something about foreign policy here. We've got Hillary Clinton talking about imposing no-fly zones, in other words, having the U.S. and the Russian Air Force come into a conflict. She is all in favor of moving divisions into the Baltics and Eastern Europe, which is provoking mm-hmm. Russia here. I mean, I really think a vote for Hillary is a vote for some kind of new war. And then there's China and conflict over the South China Seas. We are moving all kind of mm-hmm. aircraft carriers. We're going to challenge China on mm-hmm. the seas, and we're going to challenge Russia in the air. And I don't see how we can avoid another war with that kind of a policy. What's your position on both the challenging of Russia, the provoking in Syria over a war? 80% of Americans don't want any more foreign wars, and yet these politicians
That's right.
keep pushing us in that direction. What's your position? How would you prevent a war in Syria, Eastern Europe, or China?
Great. So, you know, very few Americans know that over half of our discretionary budget is being spent on these catastrophic wars. Not only are we not winning them, you know, we are creating failed states, mass refugee migrations, and worse terrorist threats. ISIS grew out of the chaos of Iraq. Al-Qaeda, in turn, grew out of the crisis in Afghanistan going way back. We trained Osama bin Laden. This was part of our policy of how to stop the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, was to create this global extremist movement related to the Mujahideen. And it was the U.S. and the Saudis that got this thing going. And with every turn of the cycle of violence, it has only become more devastating, more catastrophic, and a more vicious terrorist threat. So we're calling for a very different kind of offensive in the Middle East, a peace offensive. And it starts with a weapons embargo, which is pretty easy to create because we are supplying the majority of the weapons essentially to all parties in the Middle East. So we can initiate that weapons embargo. But I have little doubt that if we actually spoke to the Russians in a way that didn't, you know, seek to marginalize and demonize them, we could begin to explore collaboration here, because the Russians are not doing well with the terrorist threat either. It's a real threat to them. They also cannot afford a big military budget. Their military budget is a tiny fraction of ours, but their economy is also a tiny fraction of ours. They're having a hard enough time as it is. So it would behoove all of us to move forward with a peace process, starting in Syria, beginning with a weapons embargo, and then including a freeze on the bank accounts of those countries who continue to insist on funding terrorist extremism. And that means the Saudis, for example, and the Qataris, and some other folks who've been our very good allies. With all due humility, because we ourselves have been leading the charge here, you know, we need to, my administration would say, hey, folks, we're turning over a new leaf. We are hereby abiding by international law and human rights, and we are not conducting a foreign policy based on economic and military domination. We are seeking modes of collaboration for our greater common interests. And that begins with ending terrorism, the funding and arming of terrorism, which we and the Saudis have been very much engaged in, even while we've been fighting terrorism. So, you know, we need to address the terrorist threat together in a truly substantive way and an honest way. We need to address the ongoing threat of climate change, which is a direct threat to all of us. And we need to address the threat of nuclear weapons. And we need to move ahead.
I'm going to have to interrupt you, Jill. Wow, we could go on for another hour. I wanted to ask you about how you would turn to the millennials now that Bernie Sanders chickened out and supporting Hillary here. The millennials are the future of the Green Party. I'm sure we will agree. But we're going to have to do that another time. Maybe let's see what the fallout is from the election and talk about a criticism of the election. Thank you,
Jill. Sounds great.
This is Alternative Visions.
Tune in. Go to my website and join the team. Thanks.
Join the team. Go to Jill Stein website.
It's Jill2016.com.
Jill2016.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Great talking.